From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, saxophonist James Moody. The melodic saxophonist is hard of hearing and was told as a child he would soon be deaf. He started his career with Dizzy Gillespie's big band in the early days of bebop. Moody's new CD, Young at Heart, features songs associated with Frank Sinatra. Also today, advancing democracy in Russia. We talk with Sarah Mendelson, who was recently in Moscow with the National Democratic Institute, helping Russia's reformist political parties prepare for the elections. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Searchers are still trying to find more victims from TWA Flight 800. The Navy has added a specially equipped salvage ship that may try to bring a major piece of the plane's fuselage to the surface. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports from East Mauritius.
Investigators say Monday's discovery gives divers an underwater path to follow today, which may yield other plane parts, perhaps the elusive flight recorders. Meanwhile, the grim, slow task of recovering bodies is taking a psychological toll on the dozens of rescue workers. Dan Broida directs mental health services for the families of victims and workers.
They're having nightmares, they're not eating properly, and their concentration is getting a bit blurred or problematic. And these are beginning and early warning signs that they're stressed and need help.
More and more workers are seeking that help, he says. The FBI will not comment on a TV news report that preliminary tests show bomb residue on some wreckage. In East Mauritius, this is Eric Westervelt.
Atlanta police report that a man carrying a loaded gun and a knife slipped past security at the Olympic Stadium about 2 hours before last Friday's opening ceremonies. He was arrested wearing a security uniform. The breach of security occurred just hours before President Clinton arrived for the ceremony with his family. The gunman was later released on $17,000 bail. The Senate is voting on some two dozen proposed amendments to the welfare reform bill. Final passage is expected later today. The measure is similar to the one passed by the House, with a few provisions softened. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Yesterday, the Senate adopted a key Democratic amendment offered by North Dakota Senator Kent Conrad. It eases the work requirements for food stamp recipients and was adopted by voice vote. Conrad argued that the amendment was needed to prevent children from going hungry. Democrats have a number of other amendments they say are designed to make the bill less harsh on children. One important vote will come on the so-called family cap, a provision denying increased payments to welfare families that have more children. Supporters say until Congress gets serious about discouraging out-of-wedlock childbirth, it won't make much headway on the welfare problem. Critics include abortion opponents, who say the cap will lead to an increase in abortions. The White House is sending signals that changes are needed to the welfare reform bill, but is not singling out any provision for a veto threat. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
A consumer group says health maintenance organizations, or HMOs, are growing, and so are efforts to protect consumers in managed care programs. Families USA reports 33 states have passed consumer protection bills related to HMOs this year. The group says the bills dealt with several issues, including emergency room coverage, access to specialists, and the length of time mothers and newborns may stay in the hospital. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 26 points at 5,417. This is NPR. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is warning that Burma's harassment of democratic opposition is threatening stability, not only within that country, but throughout Southeast Asia. Christopher is in Indonesia for a meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations Regional Forum. The BBC's Jonathan Head reports.
Mr. Christopher's statement is a direct challenge to Southeast Asian governments to do more to bring about change in Burma. Warning of the possibility of instability, bloodshed, and an increasing number of refugees from Burma, the Secretary of State urged the ARF ministers to consider the impact of current conditions there on the region. With other governments, notably the European Union, Australia, and Canada, also expressing their concern over Burma's human rights record, the issue has dominated the ARF meeting in Jakarta. There is some acknowledgement now among Southeast Asian states that changes are needed in Burma, but they say they're still committed to a policy of constructive engagement. Burma was admitted to the 7-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations as a formal observer last weekend, a move which has been criticized by some governments as giving the wrong signals to Rangoon.
Jonathan Head reporting. An elderly woman and a 10-year-old girl died in Japan today in the wave of food poisonings sweeping parts of the country. 7 people have died, thousands have been sickened, and schools are closed. Government officials are vowing to trace the cause of the outbreak and then teach citizens how to prevent further infection. Presidential candidate Bob Dole is in his hometown of Russell, Kansas. He has no campaign stops planned today, but he is in the midst of filming campaign commercials and a video that will be shown at next month's Republican National Convention. He's visiting old friends and old haunts. He told several hundred townspeople today that they're shooting a lot of television footage, hopefully to get a lot of good advertising for the small Kansas town. Residents helped Dole celebrate his birthday yesterday. He's 73. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is James Moody, the saxophonist who was described in The New Yorker as a jubilantly swinging, rhapsodically singing rascal. What first put Moody on the map was his 1949 recording of I'm in the Mood for Love. His reworking of the melody was so good, it became the melody of a new song with a lyric by Eddie Jefferson called Moody's Mood for Love. Here's that 1949 recording. James Moody began his career in 1947 in the early days of bebop, playing with Dizzy Gillespie's big band. By the end of the 40s, he'd left the band and moved to Europe. Moody returned to the States in the early 50s to lead his own band. He played with Gillespie again during much of the 60s, but in the 70s, Moody left the jazz scene to work a steady job in a Vegas hotel band. When he returned to the jazz world, critic Gary Giddens wrote that there are few living musicians he enjoys hearing perform more than Moody. James Moody has a new recording featuring songs associated with Frank Sinatra. Here's Moody singing on the title track, Young at Heart.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you. If you're young at heart, doo-dee-bee-bee-dee-bo-doo-doo-dee-bee, for it's hard, you will find to be narrow of mind. If you're young at heart, you can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart?
James Moody, welcome to Fresh Air. And I want to say that I think this new album is delightful, and it's really delightful to hear you sing and to sing a song that's not a novelty song. Are you singing more now?
Well, maybe this might be the beginning of something. You know, maybe, who knows? You know, when you have strings like that, it makes you think you can sing, you know.
What do you think of your voice?
Well, it's a funny thing is I'm not as concerned with my voice as I am with my lisp that I have, you know, because I'm partially deaf. And I was born that way, and it doesn't mean that I have a speech impediment. It's just that I don't hear S's. So because my wife always tells me when I'm singing Mood for Love, I'd say you give me a smile, and it says it sounds like you're saying you give me a mile when I'm wrapped up in your magic, you know, in the lyrics. So anyway, that, you know, but I guess at this stage of the game, I just say what I say and hope that it comes out.
Well, has that held you back from singing? Are you self-conscious about that list?
No, really not at all, because I say what I say. I've been doing it for 71 years of talking. So if I say, you know, fairy tales can come true, you know, I don't know, too, you know, it can happen to you if you're young at heart. Doodle-dee-dee, doodle-doo-wee-dee.
Oh, I love that. Now, are there tones that you can't hear musically in an instrument?
Well, I don't know. I don't know because I can't. I don't know what I don't hear. Does that make sense to you?
No, I know what you're saying. I want to ask you a little bit more about your hearing. How old were you when you realized you had a hearing problem?
I was born that way, and I never realized it. I still haven't realized it because I hear what I hear, and that's it. See, if you don't know what you're missing, how can you say what you miss?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There was insistence that that I wear a hearing aid because I would hear so much better. And I put this hearing aid on, and I'm telling you, I thought I was going to go nuts with the clanging and banging that I heard, you know, banging, clack, clack, boom. And you could hear the tires of the car. Blah, 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 blah. I says, oh, my goodness, if people hear this, I mean, it's nerve-wracking. So what I did was I turned it off, and they said, oh, isn't that much better? I said, it certainly is.
So you've intentionally not worn a hearing aid.
Oh, no. And there's nothing that can be done, like no surgery or anything, so... Like, what I do is, like, what did they say, honey? What did they say? Honey, what was that? What was that? My wife, my honey Linda, boy, she tells me, you know, whatever it is, if I feel that I've missed something. You heard that joke, didn't you, Terry, about the guy says, oh, man, he says, boy, I just spent $4,000 on this wonderful hearing aid, you know. And the guy said, yeah. And what kind is it? The guy said, it's 12 o'clock.
It took me a second.
Yeah.
Right. So did music sound different with the hearing aid?
Oh, I wouldn't dare do that. I wouldn't dare put a hearing aid on and play music because just the way I hear it, that's the way I hear it. Because if I put the hearing aid in, then it's banging and clanging again and clinking. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. James Moody, let's take a pause here and listen to more from your new CD, Young at Heart, your new CD of Sinatra-related songs. And let's hear a ballad this time. This is In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning. Do you want to say anything about it?
Well, first of all, in the wee small hours of the morning, I like the melody, you know, da-da-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-da. And I liked it when Frank Sinatra did it. And I just figured, well, like, we'd like to do it another kind of way. And Gil Goldstein, he did a very wonderful job arranging it. So that's how that came about.
Well, here's James Moody from his new album, Young at Heart. James Moody from his new CD, Young at Heart. You started to play saxophone in high school, I think, but I think it wasn't until you were in the Air Force that you started playing for real. Tell us the story of the band that you played in the Air Force, and this was right after you got out of college.
Well, the band that I played in the Air Force was an unauthorized Air Force band because when I was in the Air Force, it was segregated. So three quarters of the base was Caucasian and one quarter was Negro. And they wanted to have a Negro band, so they formed one. And then Linton Garner, Earl Garner's brother, he was drafted and he came to the base where we were. And then Pop Reeves, he was drafted and he wrote some things for Benny Goodman. And I never will forget Linton Garner. One day he asked me, he said, Moody, he said, play your scales for me. So I said, da, 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 da. And he said, well, I said, well, what? He said, is that it? I said, yeah. He said, my boy, you're in for a rude awakening. You know, so anyway, but little by little. But, you know, I'd like to say one thing, Terry. When I was in Greensboro, North Carolina, I was 18 years old, right? And I was living in Newark, New Jersey. Do you know that the German prisoners of war used to come into town and jump off the truck, you know, with the PW on their back and those hats, and go into the restaurants and eat, and we couldn't?
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you feel about serving in the Air Force, knowing that your own country wouldn't let you into certain restaurants?
Well, what could you do? You see, because in the first place, like, there was nothing you could. After I left and went to Europe and was living in France, I would send my wife, I would send my mother a letter, and I'd have on there, it had the, like, the land of the brave, I'd put the land of the au fait, you know, or something, USA, you know. And my mother said, Jim, don't do that. I mean, you get in trouble, you know. But, hey, it was the truth, you know, because, like it was their land, you know, not mine.
My guest is saxophonist James Moody. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is saxophonist James Moody. He has a new CD called Young at Heart. You joined the Gillespie Big Band after you got out of the Air Force.
Yeah.
And it was a very innovative band. It was one of the first big bands really playing the new music of bebop. What was it like for you to be in this band? What were the most exciting parts of it for you?
Well, the most exciting thing about that band was when I grew older and found out where I was when I first was in that band, because, like I've said before, when I joined the band, Thelonious Monk was the piano player, Ray Brown was the bass player, Milt Jackson was the vibe harpist, and Kenny Clark, he was the drummer. That was the rhythm section, along with Howard Johnson, Cecil Payne, all the people like that. Now, if I would have known where I was, like, I would have fainted, you see?
Sure.
So I'm glad I was naive. I wasn't that hip, so I didn't know where I was. I mean, I knew, but I didn't. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Uh-huh.
And what was Dizzy Gillespie like as a band leader? I think you've called him your musical father.
Oh, yeah. Dizzy was wonderful, man. Then we knew each other and it was all right, you know, but I got to really know him better when I played in the quintet, you know, and, but... musically, he was bad, boy. He was bad. And Diz was always studying, too. Like, he would always, you know, he'd sit down at the piano, look at this, look at that, look at this. And he saw me, he said, Moody, this is where everything is. See the piano? I don't care what the instrument is, that's where it is. Trombone, violin, trumpet, saxophone, flute, this is where it is. You look at it, you see everything. When you play the piano, all the notes are laid out there for you. You know, and all those notes on every one of the instruments. So Diz said, you want to really know what's happening, you learn the piano. You know.
Did you?
Yeah, that's what he did. Pardon me?
Did you learn it?
Well, I can play the changes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can sit down and I can pick out what I have to do. You know, before I used to have to call a friend. Hey, could you play the changes for me so I can hear what they sound like? You know, but I don't have to do that. I can play them myself now.
Your first solo was recorded with the Dizzy Gillespie Band. The tune is called Eminon, which is no name spelled backwards.
Mm-hmm.
This was, I think, in 1947. Do you remember your solo on that record? Could you sing
it? Yeah, I remember it. Yeah, I remembered it because I wasn't supposed to take the solo. The baritone player was supposed to take it, and he didn't show up or something. And the solo was something like that.
And now, how come you remember it? Do you remember it from actually playing it or from listening to the record?
No, because a lot of times when we see each other, like sometimes I'm talking to Jimmy Heath, it's section we call each other because he's a wonderful saxophonist, or some of the guys, and we're talking, and somebody says, oh, yeah, man, you remember Eminon when we were Dizzy? Yeah. And we'd all sing it for a moment together, you know.
Now, the most famous solo that you've ever taken was on your first recording of I'm in the Mood for Love. And mm-hmm. then Eddie Jefferson, a singer who was working with you, wrote a lyric to your solo, and uh-huh. that became the song known as Moody's Mood for Love. Let's hear the Eddie Jefferson version of Moody's Mood for Love, his lyric to your solo.
There I go, there I go, there I go, there I go. Pretty baby, you are the soul, it snaps my control. Such a funny thing, but every time you're near me, I never can behave. You give me a smile and then I'm wrapped up in your magic. There's music all around me, crazy music, music that keeps calling me so very close to you, turns me your slave. Come and do with me any little thing you want to. Anything, baby, just let me get next to you. Am I insane or do I really see heaven in your eyes? Bright as stars that shine up above there in the clear blue sky. How I worry about you, just can't live my life without you, baby. Come here, don't have no fear. Wonder why I'm really feeling in the mood for love, and tell me why. Stop to think.
Now, what impact did Moody's Mood for Love have on your career?
Well, if I don't do it to this day, people said I haven't been there. I mean, that goes to show you. Like, no matter how much I practice, if I don't say there I go, or play, you know, do 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 do, then it's like I haven't been there. But like, I'm not, it doesn't make me feel like, oh, I don't want to be doing this. But I mean, I love doing it. And it's been very good to me, that that solo. And I'm honored and privileged, I believe, you know, to be able to do it.
You were living in Europe when you recorded I'm in the Mood for Love. And then
Paris.
In Paris. And then after mm-hmm. after it took off in the States, you moved back.
Yeah.
To the States and started leading your own band here. Why were you reluctant to move back?
Because of what I had told you before.
Racism.
Racism, yeah.
And that's why you moved to Europe in the first place?
No, I didn't move to Europe for that. I moved to Europe. I didn't move to Europe. What happened was, I'm being honest with you, was that my uncle lived in Europe. He lived there and he was working for the government, my uncle and my aunt. And like, I had a problem, you know, with alcohol, and I, so I kind of over, I cut that loose, and my uncle said, sis, send him over here for a couple of weeks, said, just let him relax and cool out, and things, you know, he'll be all right. So I went to Paris to stay for 2 weeks and stayed 3 years. You see, and then while I was there, I said, wow, I said, man, this is altogether different. You could go wherever you wanted to go, and you know, and things were just different. And but the only thing that drugged me about Paris was that they treated the Arabs that way.
You mean they were racist toward Arabs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
After you got back to the States, you started leading your own band, and mm-hmm. I think it was in 1958 that your, there was a club that burned down in Philadelphia. And
I think it was the Blue Note, wasn't it?
That's what I'd read. And you lost a lot of,
lost
I guess,
everything.
The band's instruments, the band's arrangements, the whole book for the band.
Yeah.
You must have been in shock after that.
No, I just reached down and picked up one of the bottles of alcohol and drank it.
Right.
And said the heck with it. Yeah. But then that really wound up where I drank and drank, and finally I went to Overbrook, which is a place for a mental institutions for mental things and for alcohol. And I went for alcohol.
Did you go yourself, or did somebody else take
myself.
You there?
I went myself.
It was your idea.
I'm sick of this. I can't use it. So I said, I'm going to go and do something about it. Yeah, so I did.
And did you play while you were there?
Play where?
While you were in the hospital, did you play music at all?
No. I didn't even want to look at a horn. No. I just started going into thinking, like, looking at astrology and trying to find the reasons why, you see, because I had been married, because I was married in France, too. And so I was just trying to, and I was, we were separated and getting a divorce, and I was just trying to find out the reasons why for a lot of things. So I looked at astrology, and I started looking at the Bible, you know. And that's how that went.
James Moody, he has a new CD called Young at Heart. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here's Moody's recording Last Train from Overbrook, which he composed and recorded shortly after leaving rehab.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with James Moody and talk about the man he's described as his musical father, Dizzy Gillespie. Also, we talk with political scientist Sarah Mendelson, one of the many young Americans who have worked in Russia to promote democratic values. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with saxophonist James Moody. His new CD, Young at Heart, features songs associated with Frank Sinatra. Moody has been recording since the early days of bebop in the late 40s, when he joined the Dizzy Gillespie Band. But in the 70s, he took an extended leave of absence from jazz. You spent about, what, 7 years in Vegas during, during the 1970s?
Yep.
It must have been so interesting to be in the middle of show business, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, playing straight ahead jazz at a club. What did you think of all the show busyness of it all? Was that entertaining for you at all, or just very crass and commercial?
You know what it was for me was a heck of a lesson, because like when I was in Dizzy's band, we'd play something, and if it was like things to come, we would say and we'd get it down, and then we'd take it up and play it. In Las Vegas, they play it just like it's supposed to be played. That's it. Bam! You know, it's gone. That's it. And you got to play it, you know. So that was a good lesson for me, and that, and tuning up, being in tune, it was like I said, you know, God works in mysterious ways, and God just showed me, in his way, how I should do things. I mean, he just put me in situations that I had to, you know, do or leave. You know what I mean?
What were the songs you had to play all the time, no matter who was singing?
Oh, well, in Vegas, whatever it is, whatever the pop song of the day is, you can rest assured that when the artist, whoever's coming in to headline for the week or 2 weeks, they'll be doing that song. You know? Like dum bum bing ding 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 ding. That song, I mean,
close to you, yeah.
Close to you. I mean, whatever the year was and whatever the pop song was, I mean, you played it to death.
Now, have you added any of those songs to your own repertoire?
Nope.
Right. Yep. Now, I want to take a pause here and play something that's basically an outtake. But it's such an entertaining outtake. And this is this was something you recorded in 1958. The tune is called The Moody One. And you stopped.
I goofed?
Yeah.
On the record date?
Well, let's play the outtake and hear the goof.
I goofed on the record date, and they left that in there. Yeah, I remember that.
Here it is. Mm-hmm. Were your outtakes usually as entertaining as this one?
Oh, sure. That's like the bloopers, you know. That was my blooper. That was my way of doing it, you know. But anybody, when they do something like that, they always say something that's a little comical, you know.
Were you surprised that this actually ended up on the record?
Well, yeah, because, like, you know, finally they said, yeah, we're going to leave it on there, too. I said, what? Yeah, I said, well, go ahead. I don't care. And then I'd go and play places. People says, I goofed on the record date.
I want to ask you something else about Dizzy Gillespie.
Uh-huh.
You were very close with Dizzy Gillespie. Were you close to him when he died?
Yeah. We were with him. I had him in my arms. There was John Faddis was there.
The trumpeter.
Yeah, Jacques Mouyel and his son, John Motley, and myself. Yeah. There were five of us in there with him when he passed. And you know what's funny? I told John, I said, John, you mark my word, 10 years from now, there are going to be 50 people in the room with this when he passed. You know, and there was no music playing. There was nothing. I mean, Diz was just sitting there, but, you know, trying to breathe deep, trying to get his breath. And his eyes were closed, you know. And Yes. He never opened them, and finally he took the last one, man, and that was, you know. So, yep, that was it, man.
Was he conscious toward the end? Did he know that you were there?
Well, the night before he knew that we were there. The night before, because Mike Lungo and myself, we went to see him. And we said, ooh, papa da, you know, yabba-dee bobby, and he tried to mouth ooh, papa da. And then the thing he did was he took his finger and put it up to his lips and made his, tried to make his jaws go out like he usually did. You know how he would do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but he was too weak, but we smiled, you know, and all like that. And I said, Mikkel, let's go, man. We'll come back tomorrow. I said that to Mike Lungo, you know. And so, you know, then when I went back the next day, like, he was in bed that night. And then when I went back the next day, he was sitting up. They had him in a chair sitting up. And he was, you know, trying to breathe. So, anyway, yeah, but I mean it. I just it's not the same. Nothing is the same anymore without Diz, man. You know.
You must feel like you owe so much of your career to him because he gave you your first job, and then you played with him off and on for so long.
Yeah, he did. When I was 21 years old, first gig. Yep. Yep. And even now, like I tell people, that when they ask me, they said, well. What do you remember of this? You know, I mean, there are many things, and what happened is sometimes I'll say, ah, that's what he meant. You know, it might be because everywhere that I've gone in the world, no matter where it was, I was there first with this. This took me everywhere first, man, you know. Like, I go to Africa, you know, just Sweden, Germany, France, all except Paris. I went there first alone. But then after that, everywhere else was there. And now when I go to those places and I'm going, boy, I say, oh, man, you know. And for the longest time, I used to call my wife. I used to call Linda, my honey, and tell her, says, honey, I called you and you weren't home. You know, she says, honey, I've been home all day. I said, well, I said, but I called and then I'd say the number. And she'd say, honey, that's Dizzy's number.
Oh, wow. Yeah. James Moody. Our thanks to drummer, record collector, and WBGO host Kenny Washington for making us a copy of his rare 1949 James Moody recording. Here's more from Moody's new CD, Young at Heart. Coming up, bringing Western campaign techniques to Russia, this is Fresh Air. Sarah Mendelson is one of the many young Americans who have spent time in Russia working on the political transition to democracy. From 1994 to 1995, she served on the staff of the National Democratic Institute's Moscow office, where she worked with Russia's reformist political parties on preparations for parliamentary and presidential elections. She helped bring Western campaign techniques into electoral politics. She's observed parliamentary elections in Russia, and this year she observed the presidential elections as part of her independent research on international efforts to build and sustain democratic institutions in post-Soviet Russia. Mendelson also teaches political science at the State University of New York at Albany. I asked her what campaign techniques she emphasized to political groups in Moscow.
It's not a sort of a big mystery what it is that you're going to bring to them. I mean, you're going to you talk about the message development, and you talk about sort of video training, political ads on television, direct mail. You give people a variety of things. You sort of say, well, look, this is how we do it. This is how it's done in Great Britain. This is how it's done in Canada. Pick and choose. I mean, if you like something, use it. If you don't like it, don't use it. And initially, people's response is often, oh, well, these things aren't going to work here. I mean, for example, direct mail. You know, the mail system isn't very good. Direct mail will never work here. Well, in fact, the first nationwide direct mail campaign went out May 9th, and it was targeted, I think it was about 3.5 million pieces of mail went out from Boris Yeltsin's team, well, from Boris Yeltsin, to all the veterans of World War II. And different letters. They had a series of different letters so that if one person living in one apartment lived next to a veteran, they'd get different letters. And if this is the first time that you've ever received a piece of mail like that, it's quite startling and, in fact, quite moving for these people.
Were you able to measure the impact that that mailing had?
Well, I've been given, the people who ran the direct mail campaign have measured it extensively, and they're quite pleased with the results, not only because Boris Yeltsin won, but also because the mayor of Moscow, whom they were working for, Yuri Lushkov, came in with a 90% turnout or 90% rating. So the feeling is, by and large, that direct mail was very effective at luring voting parts of the voting population that could possibly have gone over to the communists.
The people like yourself who were in Moscow working for democracy, did you see yourself as really working for Yeltsin since he was more of the democratic representative? Or did you see yourself as working for just the idea of voting in general and whoever wins, wins?
Absolutely not voting. Absolutely not working for Yeltsin per se. I began with NDI in September 94. In December 94, Yeltsin sent troops into Chechnya, and several of the parties that we worked with broke away from the Yeltsin, what was then called, well, what used to be called the Party of Power, which was then called the Party of War. Yeltsin was not a uncontroversial figure among the party activists with whom we worked. So I think the answer is really that it's a much larger process versus outcome. It's the sense that elections should happen, that political parties are absolutely central to a democratic state, and any efforts to increase the viability of political parties is a worthy work, in a sense, but that the whole effort at democratization goes beyond political parties. It goes beyond elections and campaigns. It involves helping to establish the rule of law. It involves encouraging the proliferation of independent television stations and the role of the media in the democratizing state. So it includes. Encouraging the development of the Central Electoral Commission, the people who bring you the elections.
I had read reports that members of the press were basically being bought off by Yeltsin, that he was basically buying good articles about him. Did you talk to any journalists who were willing to accept the money for the article?
I didn't speak specifically with journalists who accepted money, but I was witness to several what I thought were strange conversations. The day that, I guess 2 days before the second round, Yeltsin issued a, in quotes, interview that he had done with, I think it was the Interfax News Service. And it was unclear whether or not Yeltsin had actually met with the journalist conducting the interviews, or if it had been a series of questions that had been given to him and the journalist had then received written answers. And when asking Russian journalists which was it, the line that we were given was, look, Yeltsin met with them. That's what we're saying. don't ask any other questions. Basically, we're all in this together. We want Yeltsin to win. Don't dig any further. And Western journalist friends of mine would say, well, but did Yeltsin actually meet with the Interfax News people? Well, no, but that's beside the point. But I think that this brings up a larger issue, which is that the role of the media was split in many ways. Yes, in fact, there's very good evidence that the Yeltsin team bought off journalists. And in fact, that I've been told this happened in 93 as well as in 96. But I think that, I think that this is extremely problematic, obviously. I think that the situation that was confronting Russian journalists is a situation that no Western journalist has confronted. And that is that there was a choice between, or they perceived that it was a choice between going back and going forward. And that for these journalists, while they may have been able to use standard journalistic techniques to highlight the problems of Zhuganov, they were really struck with fear at the possible outcome of a Zhuganov win. In fact, there were television managers of independent television stations who said, look, we've got our bags packed. It's very clear to us if Zhuganov wins, we're out the door.
It sounds so idealistic when you hear that Americans have gone to Russia to help instill democracy and to help start democratic institutions. Yet what that sometimes practically seems to translate into is that people are going abroad to teach how to go negative and how to do mass mailings and sound bites on TV and stuff. And isn't that exactly what has kept so many Americans disenchanted about politics, as opposed to that which keeps us feeling that democracy is... I mean, people don't think of democracy as sound bites and going negative and spin control.
I think there are really two issues here. One is that regardless of whether there were Americans working in Russia, these are standard marketing techniques. And as Russia becomes...
Precisely, the marketing techniques and not the essence of democracy.
Yes, but the point is that, in fact, Russians will move towards those techniques regardless of whether or not Americans are suggesting them or showing them that, in fact, they're used in the West. What happens is you're doing two things. You're doing the sort of nuts and bolts of campaigns. This is how we do it. You can do it differently. This is not the essence of democracy. Political parties, elections are the essence of democracy. But these are the ways in which elections have evolved, not only in this country, but around the world. But I think what you also try and do is you focus on, as much as you can, the transfer of ideas, meaning the transparency of elections, the need for multi-party involvement in elections. That's a much harder thing. That's a much sort of longer-term goal, but it's part and parcel. It may sound idealistic, but really, what's the choice? I mean, would you just stay home and say, well, let's just watch and see what happens, and we don't really have any stake in it. I mean, I think that it's absolutely in U.S. national interest to see Russia evolve as a democracy. And in fact, I think it's in Russia's national interest to see Russia evolve in a democracy.
My guest is Sarah Mendelson, who has worked in Moscow bringing Western campaign techniques to political parties. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sarah Mendelson. She's worked on bringing Western campaign techniques to Russia, and she observed the parliamentary and presidential elections. A lot of people like you, a lot of Americans, younger Americans, are going to newly democratic countries to help create new democratic institutions and to help with elections. And from something I read that you wrote, I really get the sense that in Moscow, there's become a whole, like, American singles scene of young people who've come there to help create democratic institutions.
That's right. I mean, Moscow is no longer... Moscow has become a fun place. Moscow has ups and downs, of course, but you can spend all day in the trenches sort of working with political parties, and then you can go and go to a bar, go to a club and go dancing, and in fact sort of wander into a diner at 4 a.m. and have a burger and a shake. All the sort of accoutrements that go along with Westerners living abroad have come to Moscow.
Describe what the social life in Moscow is like now and how that compares to when you were there years ago when it was still a communist place.
Well, there are many, many restaurants that have sprung up all over Moscow. And most recently, there is a fabulous new restaurant where you can dine on sort of California cuisine. In fact, you can dine on New Brunswick lobsters with California wine. And these places are filled with certainly expats, but also with Russians. And you can go from there to Tex-Mex restaurants. There are lots of Tex-Mex restaurants. And so people meet and sort of compare margaritas across town. This is completely different from when I was doing research in 1991, where there were one or two hotel bars that you would go and you'd get a beer. But by and large, you met in homes, and you met in Russians' homes. And I think that there was a lot more, at least for me, there was a lot more socializing with Russians as opposed to with the expat community. At this point, I suppose because I was working with Russians, I would sort of do that by the day and then go out at night. But I think that's true for most of us. There are a few sort of diehards who really do live a much more Russian existence, who don't ever go to these restaurants or who rarely go to these restaurants, and who minimize their contact with Americans.
So what are the dating habits, the social habits in Moscow now between the Americans there who are working to open up new markets and to further democratic causes, and Russians? Is there a lot of dating-type socialization?
Well, I think the dating situation is as follows. American men tend to date Russian women. American women rarely date Russian men.
Why is that?
Well, I think what I was seeing... I think what happens is that for American men... Russian women represent a sort of pre-feminist woman, a sort of 1950s woman. And this is not to say that they are actually like this. This is to say that this is how I think a lot of American men perceive them. They tend to be somewhat softer in manner, perhaps willing to support their husbands or their boyfriends in ways that are frankly not always possible for American women who are working 60 to 70 hours a week. On the flip side, American women are in some ways quite threatening for Russian men. They make more money than most Russian men. Russian men can be quite chivalrous and they want to take American women, or they want to take women out, pay for things. And that becomes a bit awkward when the women are making much more. But I think also that American women who are overseas, you know, sort of young, independent, living this kind of life, they tend to be feminists. And Russian men, by and large, are not feminists. So there's a disconnect on that particular social aspect. But you know, it doesn't mean that they're not friends. That just means that they may not be partners for life.
My impression is that a lot of younger people are working abroad, finding jobs in newly emerging democracies. And you're in your 30s now. You have spent a lot of time in Moscow, but also teach at the State University of New York at Albany. I'm wondering if you see a pattern here, if you think that it's that there's just a trend of a lot of younger people working, at least spending some time working in other countries.
I think for people who are politically motivated, this is a very specific time period. That is the post collapse of the Soviet Union and the sort of liberation, if you will, of Eastern Europe and the Baltic states has presented for the politically minded 20s and 30-year-olds an exceptional opportunity in a way that even the Peace Corps doesn't really approach, where you can go and be a part of something that is new and struggling, that has a lot of history, that is trying to be a part of the West, but yet has its own very specific history, and that young people can do, they can get jobs that enable them to be involved in ways that they could never be involved in the West. That is, they have much more responsibility. You see a lot of young people coming in and either in democratization or in the business community and having fairly senior responsibilities so that we, you know, we'd show up with meetings with the equivalent of senators and I'd be in a meeting with, you know, other 20 and 30-year-olds meeting with, you know, the equivalent of these senators.
Mm-hmm. And giving them advice.
And, well, giving them advice or asking what they needed. I mean, I still resist the idea that we were there to learn as much from them as I think they were from us. But certainly, you know, having a business meeting with these people. I mean, how many times do 20 and 30-year-olds, other than George Stephanopoulos, have meetings with prominent American politicians on a regular basis?
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah Mendelson, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Sarah Mendelson is back in the States. She teaches political science at the State University of New York at Albany. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. We also have assistance from Phoebe Vanskoy. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Cherie Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.